So, last week we read about the death of Sarah at the age of 127 and the marriage of Yitzchak to Rivka. We talked about how the Torah is Marich in that particular detail. This week already, although Avram is still alive, there's the way the Torah is written. When the Torah describes the Avos, the Torah does not really follow a strict chronological order. So, for example, we read last week that Avram dies at the age of 175. But the emphasis is Avram is still very much alive because Yitzchak has a child when Yitzchak is 60. And when Yitzchak is 60, Avram is 160. So Avram lives for another 15 years. So if Avram lives for another 15 years, why does the Torah say that Avram died? The answer is, the way the Torah works, at a point in time at which Avram is no longer the focus of the narrative, the Torah describes, Avram is dead because we're no longer going to focus on him. So in fact, Avram is still going to live another 15 years, but we no longer have the story about him. Now, again, remember the Machlokas Tosfot, Rashi, well, it's Machlokas Midrashim, really. Rashi brings the Medrash that Rivka was 3 years old when she married Yitzchak. Tosfos brings another Medrash that she was 14 years old. But either way, she was married for 20 years before she had a child, because Yitzchak married her at 20. So if she had a child, it was 23, or Yitzchak married her at 14, in which case she had a child at 34. Either way, there was 20 years of marriage. So the Pasuk says that Yitzchak was married to Rivka 20 years. She had no children. And the Pasuk says they both prayed, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu answered the prayer of Rivka. So this is interesting. Why does the Torah say Hashem answered the prayer of Rivka? So Rashi brings a Gemara that says, the Torah says they answered the prayer of Yitzchak. So Rashi brings the famous Gemara that says Yitzchak had the prayer of a tzaddik, the son of a tzaddik, and Rivka's prayer was that of a tzaddik or a tzaddikas, the daughter of a rasha. So the prayer of a tzaddik ben tzaddik is greater than the prayer of a tzaddik ben rasha. And that's why, even though they both prayed, HaKadosh Baruch Hu primarily answered the prayer of Yitzchak and not the prayer of Rivka. So people ask Kasha, L'chaira, if the Gemara means to say that the tzaddik ben tzaddik has what's called zechus avos. Zechus avos means it's not only the tzaddik zechus, but his father, etc. The tzaddik ben rasha doesn't have that zechus, right? That's how the simple meaning. But people ask Kasha, L'chaira, the svara should be the opposite. If it's true, as Chazal say elsewhere, that the place where the Baal Tshuva stands, the one who comes back to God, is greater than the place of the Tzaddik Gomor, then L'chaira, the prayer of a Rivka should be greater than the prayer of a Yitzchak, because Yitzchak is only a Tzaddik, and Rivka has the status of a Baal Tshuva. V'lakum sh'ba v'tshuva imdim, tzaddikim gemurim, einam yichaylam lamad ba. So why would the prayer of a Tzaddik ben Tzaddik be greater than the prayer of a tzaddik, the daughter of a rasha? So the Altar of Kelim, was we saw Solanter's greatest Talmud, Simcha Zissel of Kelim, says that the meaning of a tzaddik ben tzaddik means that a person whose father was a tzaddik in one particular way, and he became a tzaddik in a different way. In other words, each person has to find their own unique derech in Avodas Hashem. You can't simply be a copier, although, once again, of course, you learn from your parents, you learn from your rabbis, but ultimately you have to serve Hashem based on your own unique strength. Now, we know that Abraham served Hashem primarily through the midah of loving kindness and chesed. Yitzchak served Hashem through the midah of inner strength and gevurah. Now, if you think about it, if you understand that every person has to find his own way, the avodah of a tzaddik ben tzaddik, in a way, is harder, Because once Rivka knew the emes, she knew she had to break away from her father. She knew she had to do her own thing. She knew she had to be an individual because there was no role model. But if your father is Avraham Avinu, who better to follow than that role model? So if Yitzchak became a tzaddik ben tzaddik, not just a ben tzaddik, but a tzaddik ben tzaddik, finding his own individual derech, in spite of the fact that his father was a great tzaddik, that took a greater discipline and a greater understanding than even a tzaddik ben Rasha. I understand, because for Yitzchak to be an individual in his avodas Hashem was a greater accomplishment than even Rivka, because Rivka knew the way. For Yitzchak, it would have been so easy to be an imitator. Right? That's what the Elder of Kelim says, is the maila of a tzaddik ben tzaddik, to be a tzaddik in your own way. It's like the story goes, there was Chassidus Rebbe, who had many minhagim different than his father. So somebody asked him, why are you not following your father's minhagim? So he says, I am following my father's minhagim. My father's minhagim were not to do what his grandfather did, doing the same thing. Now, obviously, we don't mean that in a totally literal sense. Obviously, a person should follow minhagim, and a person, but the point is, every person has his own derech in avodas Hashem. And you try to find your own derech. You don't blindly follow someone mechanically, but you try to serve Hashem with the nuances of your own personality, and that is the idea of a tzaddik ben tzaddik. Okay, so that's one point of why HaKadosh Baruch Hu listened to the prayer of Yitzchak more than the prayer of Rivka.
That comparison between Rivka and Yitzchak, is that on a quantitative level, or because like what more could Rivka have done?
There's nothing more that she could have done. It just happened to be that Yitzchak's accomplishment was greater. It happens to be that Rivka didn't have the opportunity for that particular accomplishment. But for Yitzchak to do what he did was a greater accomplishment than even for what Rivka did, what she did. You know, it's not that there's a taina on Rivka that she should have done something else, but Lamai said she didn't have that particular opportunity. Now, the other thing is that this is the second of the imahos that we know had a fertility problem. Sora was infertile. She did not have a child till she was 90. And Rivka was much younger, but Rivka did not have a child for 20 years. And, of course, we're also going to find later that at least Rachel, Yaakov's most beloved wife, also was an akaret, did not have children for many years until she had Yosef and then Binyamin. So, yeah.
According to the Midrash, the Rashi brings that Rivka was 3.
Yeah.
Are we surprised that she didn't have children for 20 years?
Well, thank you. Well, I think we're still surprised. Now, obviously, it's not a serious fertility problem at 23 without a child. But still, the Gemara assumes for a Dover Pashat that once a girl is 12 or 13, she's able to have children. So there still was at least 10 years in which she could have had children. The Gemara says it's a sakana for a child below 12 to get pregnant. But after that age, you know, that can happen. Now, the other point is, the Gemara in Yevamos remarks, why are the imahos akaros? Why is Sarah an akara, Rivka an akara, Rachel's going to be an akara, a woman who cannot have children? L'chaira, these are such righteous people. Why should they be akaros b'chlau? And the Gemara says a very beautiful answer. HaKadosh Baruch Hu misaveh l'tfilosan shel tzaddikim. Hashem was yearning for their tefillah. Hashem was yearning for their prayers. So Hashem made them akaros so they would pray to Hashem. Now there's a very important insight here that applies to us as well. We think that, why do I daven, why do I pray? I have needs in my life. Since I have needs, I need a job, I need health, I need a mat, I need a shidduch, I need children. So the need creates the prayer. Here we see exactly the opposite. Intrinsically, the imai should not have had the need. It's not the need that creates the prayer. It's the prayer that creates the need. What Hashem really wants is the prayer. Elamai, Nebuch. If we have everything we need, we don't daven. So Hashem creates needs in our life so that we should feel the desire to pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because the real need of a person is not the need. The real need of a person is the prayer to be makashir your neshama to Hashem. But Hashem creates needs in our lives, so we'll pray. So in many, many ways, you can almost say, to take this even further, that I don't pray because I have needs. I have needs, so I'll pray. That's what the Gemara is teaching us. And therefore, the real need that prayer addresses is the ability to pray. Meaning, it's almost as if, on some level, it's almost immaterial if Hashem gives you what you ask for or not. Because the main point is the connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in that tefillah. That's why the Chiddush Yerim says a very famous word, the first Ger Rebbe, Chiddush Yerim. Rim is Rabbi Yitzchak Meir, altar. He says that the Nachash was cursed by the story of the Eitz Hadas. The Nachash was cursed that you will eat dirt all the days of your life. So the Chiddush Yerim says, what type of curse is that? The Nachash will never have to look for food. Dirt is all over the place. Okay, maybe it doesn't taste so good, whatever. But it's not a curse. The answer is, it's the ultimate curse. He'll never have the occasion to ask for God. Ask for God's help. Hashem basically says to him, I'll give you what you want, just get out of here. The example would be if there's somebody, let's say, is bothering you for a donation for tzedakah, from a shulach. So you might tell your secretary, if you have a business or something, just get him out, give him what he wants, and get him out of here. That's a much more disdainful treatment than to interact with him. You know, they tell the story, and they say this is a true story. I don't know if it's true, so it may be a mushel, but they say it over as a true story about a wealthy man whose wife died, and he married a second wife. And the second wife took a great dislike to his teenage son. He had a 16 or 17-year-old son. And she couldn't stand him in the house. So one day the father calls him. He calls him in. The father says, listen, here are the keys to your car. I'm giving you a car. I'm giving you my credit card. You have an unlimited credit card. I rented an apartment for you in the city. But we can never talk or see each other again. Now, on a superficial level, you might think, this is some teenager's fantasy. Car, credit card, apartment, you know, parents aren't going to be on his back again. Everything he wants. But on a deeper level, you can see how painful it is. Physically and materially, the kid has everything that he wants. But he doesn't have his father's love. He doesn't have a connection. And that's what the Nachash was banished. So the Chiddush Yerim says, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts occasions in our lives, when we have to pray to Him, that's not something to feel. People feel, oh, why is God rejecting me? Why is Hashem punishing me? It's the other way around. Hashem wants to hear from us. Hashem wants us to feel His presence. Hashem wants us to turn to Him. And it's actually a sign of closeness. On the other, if you have absolutely everything you want, you have no need to pray to Hashem, that could be a sign. Hashem is saying, I don't want to bother with you. You know, even in yeshiva it was that way. You know, it used to be that the altar of Slobodka only gave mussar to the people that he felt could really grow from it. In other words, if you were a guy who wasn't going to shir, wasn't going to davening, wasn't going to learning, and the altar didn't give you mussar, that was the biggest mussar. Then you really felt, you know, you really felt that you didn't matter to him anymore. That he gave up on you. So they tell stories about guys who would come late and they would go up to the altar and they thought maybe he didn't notice and say, oh, I was late today. I was an hour late today. You know, I missed davening. They were hoping he would say something to them. And he would say, okay, that's fine. And that was the biggest muster. That's just, you don't even matter, you know. You're not even worthwhile enough to talk to you. And that's the idea of tefillah. That's why the imais are our chorus. Okay, so, when people ask, what's the purpose of davening? Sometimes the purpose of davening is to daven, meaning to have a relationship with Hashem. It's not to get something out of the relationship. It's to have the relationship, to be able to unburden myself, to be able to talk, to be able to feel that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is listening. And even if he decides no, and this is the famous statement that everybody says, which is 100% emes, people say, why doesn't Hashem answer me? And the answer is, he does answer you. Sometimes the answer is no. Now that's a very, very beautiful way of saying it, because there's all the difference in the world between saying Hashem ignores me and saying Hashem always listens to me. Then he decides for my own good, it's better for me not to have what I want for whatever reason. In one case, Hashem is indifferent. In the other case, it's a loving God who makes decisions that are best for me that I can't understand, but I know it comes from love, and I know there's a relationship, and that can make it easier to bear whatever the difficulty is. So in Yiddish, it comes across very nice. Someone asked the Panovich Rav, "Var was er entfert nicht?" Why does he not answer? Er entfert nicht. So the Panovich Rav says, you have to put the comma in a different place. Er entfert, comma, nicht. He answers, no, not er entfert nicht. He doesn't answer, er entfert nicht. He answers, no, the same words, just in a different way. You get a different meaning from the sentence. Okay. But be it as it may, Rivka's prayers are answered, your Yitzchak's prayers are answered, and Rivka now finds that she is carrying twins. And there are some ominous signs in these twins. Again, the way Rashi explains, well, the Pasuk just says the twins were fighting. They were a rowdy bunch. Inside there, Rashi tells us, the famous Rashi, that whenever she walked by a house of divine worship, a house of Torah learning, again, whatever Torah meant in those days, obviously, Yaakov wanted to come out. Whenever she walked by a place of Avodah Zarah, this other one wanted to come out. And basically, she didn't know what was going on. Now, the Mefarshim explained that she actually had a fear. It's very interesting. She had a fear that this was one child. She didn't know there were two. And seeing one child, she was afraid that this child would have uncontrollable inclinations to sometimes be good and sometimes be evil. A very, very powerful Yetzer Tov, and a very, very powerful Yetzer Hara. And that was unbearable to her, because she didn't want to have a child that would be subject to such an evil that could override her good. So she goes, now what does the Pasuk say? She went to inquire of God. So the simple meaning is Nevuah, but Rashi explained she was not a Navi herself, but she went to the yeshiva of Shem and Aver. Aver is Shem's grandson, but Shem, the survivor of the Mabul. Shem is also Malchit Tzedek, who is the king of Yerushalayim, and she wants to know what's going on. So Shem tells her, Shnei Goyim Bevitnech, meaning you're making a mistake. You think it's one that's going to struggle. In fact, it's two different ones, twins. Now, some of fortune bring out from the Zohar, actually, that it was only Rivka's request that made it two. Originally, the original plan was, it was one. And there may have been a mistake in splitting it into two, because instead of the mixture of good and evil, in which perhaps the evil could be redeemed by the good, it now became a dichotomy. Pure good and pure evil. So that's an interesting question. You know, what makes the world better off? Meaning to say, is it better off that the evil should be combined with the good so that the good can overpower it? Or is it better that the evil be separated from the good so that the evil not contaminate the good? Rivka essentially said she could not live with a mixture of the good and evil. So it had to be separated. But indeed, the problem is that the neshama of Esav also potentially had a lot of Kedusha, but by being separated from Yaakov in that way, its own potential could never be realized. So it's an interesting point that the splitting of the Shnei Goyim was not originally part of the divine plan, but it came part of that plan as a result of Rivka's intercession. So Shnei Goyim Bevitnech, there are two nations, two children that are going to be great nations in your womb. Ulaom milom yematz, and one nation shall always be stronger than the other nation. Verav yaavod tzair. But the older, now this is a very, very ambiguous phrase. In the womb, how do you know what is older? Verav, the older, yaavod tzair, shall be subservient to the younger. Verav yavod soir. Now, obviously, Esav is treated as the older one because he came out first. But it's interesting. That means Rivka, this is something people often overlook, although it's a very obvious point. Rivka was told by Shem ben Noach, Verav yavod soir. The older shall be subservient to the younger. Now think about this. Many, many years later, when Rivka manipulates the brachos so that Yaakov gets the brachos instead of Esav, and we'll discuss this, probably not today, that, well, how could Rivka engage in that deception, etc.? How could that be right? In many ways, one could say that Rivka is simply acting to ensure the fulfillment of the divine prophecy, Verav Yavod Soir, which as far as we might conclude, Yitzchak might not be aware of that. Which raises another question, why didn't Rivka tell him? But it does not say Rivka ever told Yitzchak that. So Yitzchak wants to give the brachos to Esav, but Rivka's imperative is Rav Yavod Soir. So it's an obvious point people often overlook, that Rivka is in possession of a certain bit of information. Now, you might ask operationally, well, what do we mean that Yaakov rules over Esav? I mean, that hasn't happened. Well, so again, it has Limosa Moshiach, etc., you know. But eventually, there is this notion of Rav Yavod Soir. Okay. Now, we then go on, again, right? We're looking at a different number of scenes today. We'll come out and connect these either today or the next time. And that is, okay, so Rivka's in possession of this information. Apparently this has placated her. Children are born. We are told that Esav is ruddy, a darker complexion, etc. And Yaakov was holding onto his heel. So the word Esav is Asu, complete. Later he's called Edom, right? And he is the forefather of the Edomite race. And the Edomite race, according to our tradition, eventually morphed into the Roman Empire. That's why we call this Gullus that we're in, is called the Gullus of Edom, the Gullus of Esav. Right? So Esav means a completed one, because he already had all of his hair. Edom is a ruddy complexioned one. And Yaakov is called Yaakov because he's holding onto the heel as if to pull him back, etc. Now, the pasuk then says, Vayigdalu hanaorim, the young men grew up. And Esav became a hunter, and Yaakov became a dweller of tents, meaning a student of Torah. So here there's a very interesting word of Rav Shimshon Nafal Hirsch. And some people don't like to say this word because they think it's disrespectful to the Avos. I've gotten in trouble by saying it, so I probably will not say it in the Beis Medrash. I get in trouble when I say it. But again, it's Rav Hirsch, it's not me. So if you don't, you know, if you have a trouble with it, it's Rav Hirsch. If you like it, it's mine. If you don't like it, it's mine. Rav Hirsch says that the key problem here is Vayigdalu hana'arim. What's the pshat? You know, when parents have twins, these are not identical twins, but when parents have twins, they often raise the twins the same. They dress them the same. Although I have to say, among the Hasidim in there, in this interesting minhag, maybe you'll notice this, they dress all their kids the same. You ever notice, let's say, a family of five boys or five girls, they all wear the identical clothing. There actually is brought down in Sifrei Hasidus, there's a certain inyan not to dress children differently because, number one, that might create jealousy among the kids where one kid might think, oh, you know, why is he dressed better than me? etc. So they have a minhag b'chlal of dressing everybody the same. But certainly with twins, people do make a point. You know, both of my twins, I dress the same, etc. And v'yigdalu hana'arim, a person interprets this way. When Yitzchak and Rivka had twins, they raised them the same way. In other words, 18 hours in the Beis HaMedrash. Rav Hirsch says, when you raise Esav the same way you raise Yaakov, one size fit all, not only will you not make Esav into Yaakov, but you're going to get a Russia. This is an amazing thing. Rav Hirsch says, Shlomo HaMelech tells us, Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko. You must raise a child according to his way. What does his way mean? Each person has an individual way, a different personality. Esav also had great talents. Esav had energy. Esav had the ability to organize things, get things done. He was a very practical person. But Esav needed time to play baseball or basketball or run around. To take an Esav and put him in the same atmosphere and environment as a Yaakov is going to take his ability to have become a righteous person. And instead he becomes a rebellious Russian. So you see what your first is saying. Vayigdalu hana'arim. Because the youngsters were raised the same way, that is why Esav became the rebel that was the hunter. Because what was good for Yaakov turns out to be destructive for Esav. Now, as I say, some people say, you know, we don't really have the right to look at the Avos and say, oh, Yitzhak and Rivka were not good parents, and that's why, you know, Esav became a Russia, etc. Obviously, there are cosmic factors at work here, but the insight itself is a very good insight. The insight is a very good insight, and in fact, it's a phenomenon that we discover in the yeshiva communities, and that is, children need different approaches. That what is good for one child can be very, very destructive for the other child, and that's Shlomo HaMelech's words, Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darkai. The goal of all chinuch is not to change somebody, but rather have him actualize his potential within the framework of who he is. That's a very important idea. For example, the Gemara tells us in Shabbos that if you're born under the constellation of Mars, the red planet, you will be a shedder of blood. You will love blood. But you can choose to either be a shochet, a mohel, or a murderer. You see? So, if I have such a child, my goal is not to make him hate blood. If I try to give him blood aversion, he'll rebel. My goal is not to change him. My goal is to show him that his nature can be directed to a good and positive way. But Yigdal and Arim is the opposite idea. And that is the idea in which Yitzchak and Rivka tried to squelch the bad qualities that Esav had, as opposed to redirecting them. And that turns into destruction. In fact, Rav Hirsch wants to say, that's why many years later, Yitzchak asks Esav to hunt and bring him food. What is he trying to do, Rav Hirsch says? He's trying to say, okay, you're a hunter. I accept that. But use it for good. Use it for mitzvahs. Use it for kibud avim. Now the problem is, Rav Hirsch says, it was too late. Although Esav did have, the truth is, Esav in fact did have that one mitzvah, kibud avim, but the derech klal, it was too late to put Esav in the right derech. Essentially, Yitzchak is doing later what should have been done when they were children. That's how he learned. So again, as I say, some people will criticize you, so don't say it at the Shabbos table. Unless, you have to gauge whether this is the type of words they would like. But it is the insight of Rav Shimshon Paul Hirsch, that Vayiklu Hanoarim is the opposite of Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky used to say that sometimes in yeshivas are like the hotels in Sodom. What is that? Sodom, we know, wasn't very hospitable, but there was a hotel in Sodom. But they only had one bed that you had to fit into. In fact, the Greeks have a myth that way, so the procrustean bed, that actually is an expression in English. And that is, if your legs were too long, they overhang the bed, they would cut them off. And if your legs were too short, they would stretch until they snapped. Meaning, one size fit all. You either fit the bed, or we would make you fit the bed, as opposed to giving you a bed that your body could fit on. So Rav Yaakov says, all too often, our chinuch system is a one-size-fit-all, in which you have to fit the bed, or we stretch it until your legs break, or we cut off your legs, as opposed to trying to develop a mahalich that is conducive. Again, primarily, I think Rav Yaakov was talking about elementary education. He wasn't talking about the older yeshivas, but still, even within older yeshivas, we have this issue. Some people, for example, might have special talents in halacha, which might not be encouraged because we have a particular curriculum and it's a particular way of learning. Right? Some people are better in bikias and not in. Right? So, of course, everyone has to try to grow in everything, but sometimes we're not given the opportunities to emphasize that which is our unique kochos. And as a result, that which we could be especially good in atrophies, because it's not cultivated. But they have a famous mashal. It's from the secular community. It's a very cute mashal. I don't remember all the details. It was about a school for animals. You know, squirrels are very good at tree climbing, and certain animals can swim, etc. But they decided that it's important that all animals have basic skills. So they required that, the eel learn how to swim. They required that everybody learn how to do what everyone else does. But the net result was, instead of people excelling in what they could excel in, or animals, everybody became mediocre. In other words, everybody kind of became average in everything, and they did not excel in what they could really do good in. And that's sometimes the dilemma that we have. Now, Esav was quite a skilled hunter, you recall, because Yitzchak could only eat, since Yitzchak kept the whole Torah, like Abraham, Yitzchak could only eat something that was shechted. So how could Esav hunt animals for him? So it says Esav was able to shoot an arrow, so it's cut exactly the place of the neck that the shechita, he could shoot a deer, you know. By the way, I even saw a little bit of a scientific explanation for this, because they say when deer are in heat, there is a big swelling under their neck, around their neck. So it actually comes down like 3 or 4 inches. So theoretically, a hunter has a space that he could cut it through. But this was Esav's talent. Derech Agav, there's a famous tshuva from the Nedev Yehuda. The Nedev Yehuda was asked by the Jew, who was a wealthy Jew, and he had an estate. And there were a lot of animals, like your European noblemen have these estates where they go around hunting. He says, is there anything wrong with the Jew hunting? Recreational hunting, NRA, I just like to hunt. So the interview discusses a lot of halakhic problems, such as, you know, causing pain to animals and the like. But he says at the end that even if, let's say, you don't kill the animal right away, or I'm sorry, you do kill the animal right away, so the animal doesn't suffer, etc. But he says, hunting, by definition, is the pleasure of Esav. It is not the activity of Yaakov. And a person who is cultivating any joy out of destroying life, even if you're not violating halacha, he says this is the midah of Esav that does not belong into Klal Yisrael. So he was very much against the whole concept of recreational hunting. But I always thought to myself an interesting question. Now they have, I don't know if any of you play with guns or anything, hopefully not, but they have target practices where you shoot clay, called clay pigeons. So is there anything wrong with, so Levi Yehuda is condemning the concept of killing animals as the umness of Esav. Is there any problem with shooting targets? It could be that's okay. It could be like any other recreation. But I thought that maybe it's still not such a good thing because it'll tend to affiliate you with people who like to hunt, meaning to say it's not so much a question of the activity, but it's a question of the chabura that you become a part of. And that chabura will have a different value system in different ways. Okay, we'll stop here.
Just two quick questions. Yeah. Why didn't Rivka Emanuel go to Yitzchak or Abraham to ask the question, why should you go to Shem Ba'eva?
a good question. Now, why didn't you go to Yitzchak? The Netziv says an interesting thing generally. The Netziv says that Rivka was in awe of Yitzchak, and she felt she could not approach him and all sorts of things, which is why later she doesn't even tell him about Esav. You know, she just engages in the deception because Yitzchak was like Kodesh Kedoshim. She felt she could not approach him. Remember, she got married at the age of 3, and he was a korban, and he was very separated from the world. Why didn't she go to Avram? It could very well be, especially if you learn, like the Zohar suggests, that originally there were supposed to be two people, and she, one person rather, and she asked that it be one, because she felt, actually the other way around, originally it would have been one person, and she asked that it be two. It could be that she was afraid that Avram would not agree to that. Avram would have preferred to have that one person in which he'd eventually be able to be a tzaddik. In other words, Shay might give her a bracha, but she didn't want Avram to have a veto. Avram would have a call up to veto then.
She's almost like looking for the shit that she wanted.
Well, maybe she was afraid that without Avram's rishus, she couldn't get what she needed, but she felt Shay would give her that bracha. That's a good question. But Yitzchak directly, the Netziv says, she felt she could not